as he swiped up the stack. About the cards or Tyler, I wasn't sure. A new group of residents wandered in, and a few nurses shuffled in and out, carrying clipboards. We were running out of time. Dad stacked all the cards, and I placed my hand over his. "Dad, I need to talk to you."
"I thought that's what we were doing,"
he said. "Dad, listen. We took care of it. The police can't question you. Do not let anyone question you. You tell us right away, or the nurse, or the doctor. They're not allowed. You don't have to talk to them. You understand?"
Of course not. I wouldn't,"
he said. "But you did."
"I wish I'd been a better father, Nick."
"Dad, don't..."
"I really do. I can see it now that it's gone. But you can't go back, can you?"
I shook my head. "No, you can't." He tapped the side of his head.
"This is my penance, don't you think?"
Like losing his mind was the price to pay for being a shitty father. "You weren't mean. You weren't bad. He wasn't anything. He made me laugh, and he gave me a roof over my head and food in the kitchen, and he never raised a hand to me or his voice. For a lot of people, that would make him good. A good father. A good man." He leaned across the table, took my hand again.
"Are you happy, Nick?"
"Yes," I said. "I had everything I wanted waiting for me in Philadelphia. A whole life there."
"Good. Good."
I squeezed his hand. "You don't deserve this," I said. "Any of this." He started drumming his fingers again, double time, leaned toward me, and lowered his voice to a raspy whisper.
"Nick, listen to me. I have to pay. I have to."
"I'll take care of everything," I said. "Don't talk about it anymore. Nothing. Not a word. To anyone. Got it?"
"Got it,"
he said. "But I knew it would last only an hour or so. I need you to focus. I need you to remember this."
"I'll remember, Nick."
He lifted his face to mine, his eyes like a child's, waiting for me to explain. I looked down at my hand over his, at the age spot speckling the back of his hand, the freckles on my own. "Dad, they want to bring you down to the station. You have to stop talking. Please." He opened his mouth to speak, but I held up my hand to stop him. Over Dad's shoulder, I saw Everett standing just inside the cafeteria entrance, his eyes quickly finding me. I raised my hand, and Dad followed my line of vision. "Dad, I want you to meet someone. This is Everett," I said as he approached. "Remember who Everett is. Please." He looked at Everett, then at my bare hand, and smiled.
"Sure, sure. Nice to meet you, Everett."
Everett shook my dad's hand.
"Same to you, Patrick. Sorry Christmas didn't work out."
We were supposed to fly in and out for a Christmas Eve visit before returning to spend the rest of the holiday with Everett's family, but a snowstorm had derailed our plans and we never rebooked. But this was a detail too hard for Dad to pull from his memory. He made a noncommittal noise that to Everett probably sounded like displeasure. Everett turned to me.
"Everything's all set here, unless you want to stay for dinner?"
All at once, I felt like I was 17 again, sitting in the kitchen with my dad asking if I was staying or going. "Going," I'd say. Always going. Had my foot out the door as soon as I stopped trying to convince myself my mother might live. "I've got a lot to do," I said. "But I'll see you later, Dad." Everett placed his card on the table.
"I told the director and the nurses up front, but if anyone comes to talk to you, anyone at all, you give me a call."
Dad raised an eyebrow at me as I walked away. When I looked over my shoulder, he was still watching. I shook my head once, praying he would remember. I excused myself to the bathroom while Everett chatted with the woman behind the front desk. I closed the door to the stall and dialed Tyler, unease coursing through my veins. "Pick up, damn it," I mumbled, but of course he didn't. I considered calling information and getting the number for Kelly's to see if he was there, but from outside the restroom I heard the faint echo of Everett's voice.
"What exactly was Patrick Farrell saying?"
I raced out of the room. "Everett," I called, watching him slowly pull back from the reception desk. "Ready?" Gossip. The most dangerous part of an investigation. Infectious and inescapable. This was something I was all too familiar with, even before my job as school counselor. There's a danger to it because it grows out of something real. A seed in the earth giving life on its own. It's all tangled together. The truth, the fiction, and sometimes it's hard to pick apart. Sometimes it's hard to remember which parts truly exist. When Corinne disappeared and we ran out of places to search, people to question, leads to track down, the only thing left for people was the talk. About Corinne and Bailey and me, reckless and drunk on life, never thinking of the consequences. How we passed around a bottle in the clearing outside the caverns and invited boys inside. How we lifted candy bars from the convenience store. On a dare. Always a dare. And didn't respect property or authority. How we had no boundaries with each other. A tangle of limbs and hair and sun-kissed skin. They swapped boyfriends even, you know. Because look at the evidence sitting neatly in the box. Jackson kissing Bailey. Corinne hitting on Tyler as I watched. The three of us spinning, blurring, like ghosts in a field of sunflowers. And me, on the outside of the Ferris wheel, watching death rushing by. We lived too close. Too close to each other, too close to some mysterious edge. Too reckless and invincible. Too naive to our own mortalities. Just too. The talk, that maybe we brought it on ourselves. Maybe we did. And on the other side of the talk, Daniel and Jackson and maybe Tyler, the ones to watch with a wary eye, the ones who circled us, watching, waiting, the ones who let their anger break free, who acted, who broke up with us, who pushed us away when they were displeased and then came back for more. Who was really surprised, looking from the outside in? After all the talk, I didn't understand how any of them stayed. I drove slowly because of the glare coming from the sun nearly setting, and the roads that wind gradually and then sharply with no warning, and the deer that could be standing there, frozen on the double yellow line, and because Everett was plowing through his emails and we were about to lose service around that next bend. I waited for him to start cursing at his phone. "Want to stop at the library again?"
"No,"
he said, leaning his head against the window.
"It can wait until tomorrow."
"Hungry?" I asked.
"Famished."
"Good. I know a place." I cast a quick glance at him. "All I have at home right now are microwave dinners. We can hit the store tomorrow."
"You need to eat better," he said. "You look like you've lost weight."
To judge from the way my pants were fitting, I probably had. I'd been busy, skipping meals, filling my gut with coffee and soda until I could feel the acid churning and rising. Everything else tasted either metallic or stale. I parked in the lot behind Kelly's pub because the front streets were already lined with cars, and because that was where the residents parked. Tyler's truck wasn't there, but Jackson's bike was in the corner slot. The Friday evening crowd was different from the daytime crowd. The college kids, home and looking for something to do. The after-work crowd catching a few extra drinks before returning to their families. But the smell was the same as always. Alcohol, grease, perfume mixed with sweat. There were two people behind a full bar, Jackson at the far end and a woman I vaguely recognized with a too-tight top and super straight hair to her waist. She looked in my direction as I entered.
"Seat yourselves,"
she said, nodding toward the tables as if I didn't know how it worked here. I slid into a two-person table pressed up against the window, in full view of the vestibule connecting the stairs to the upstairs apartments. "Look at the menu. I'll go get us some drinks," I said, standing. Everett gestured to the waiter and waitresses, making the rounds, but I shook my head. "It's faster this way. Trust me." I walked over to Jackson's side of the bar and knocked on the countertop, since his head remained down.
"Gee, what brings you around today, Nick?"
he asked with a smug smile. "Vodka tonic," I said. "Double."
"Rough day?"
"And a water." Jackson paused and looked over my shoulder at Everett, who was studying the menu intently in the dim light.
"Who the fuck is that?"
"Everett. "My fiancé," I said, as Jackson's bloodshot eyes stared back at me. "Have you seen Tyler? I need to talk to him."
"So you thought you'd bring your fiancé to his place? That's cruel even for you."
I flinched. "It's an emergency."
"Haven't seen him, Nick,"
he said, sliding the drinks in front of me.
"But this..."
He tilted his head toward Everett.
"Is not the best way to get his attention."
I sipped my drink. "Do me a favor," I said, pointing to the vodka tonic. "Keep these coming." At the table, Everett watched me as I ordered, and when the waitress left, the corner of his mouth was tipped up, and I didn't think it was the alcohol just yet.
"Never heard you talk like that to anyone but me,"
he said.
"It's cute."
My accent was never as strong as most people's here. My father wasn't from here. My mom was, but she left, got out, went to school, met my dad, got married, had a career, a whole life out there. But she came back with Daniel. Said she wanted to raise her kids where she grew up, where her parents lived and died and were buried. She's buried beside them now. When I left, I learned to mask the accent, faint though it was, to clip my words, shorten the vowels, tighten the I's, sharpen the A's, to speak with a casual efficiency until I sounded like I could be from anywhere else. The accent came out when I was drunk, and I wasn't drunk often. I wasn't drinking now, but it was seeping in nonetheless.
"You fixin' to get drunk and take advantage of me, Nicolette?"
Everett asked, and I forced a smile. I spent most of dinner staring at the open door, made irrationally angry by Tyler's absence, by his visits with my father, by the questions I had to get answered, by the way I could imagine Tyler looking at his phone, seeing it was me and deciding to ignore the call. We were almost done with our burgers, and Everett had just finished his third double vodka tonic when Tyler arrived. He paused for a moment, scanning the crowd from the entrance, caught sight of me, caught sight of Everett, and then he was gone. "I'll be right back," I said. "Bathroom." Everett's back was to the door, so he didn't see me push through the crowd and turn right out of the vestibule instead of heading to the other side of the bar where the bathrooms were. "Hey," I called, but Tyler didn't stop moving up the stairs. "I need to talk to you." He paused on the steps but didn't turn around.
"Is that him?"
I stomped up the steps after him, lowering my voice. "You visit my dad? Why do you visit my dad?" He turned around, and we were way too close. I pressed my back into the railing.
"What? I have a project nearby. I swing by for lunch once a week. He could use the company. I'm right there."
"He could use the company? Are you trying to make me feel guilty?"
"No, I'm not trying to make you feel anything."
He seemed to notice how close we were standing, and he took a breath, stepped back.
"Your mom died, and he checked out. I know. I was there. I get it. You don't owe him anything. Nobody blames you."
"That's not why I don't... I have a job and a life. I can't just stop because my dad literally drank himself into oblivion." He nodded.
"Fine, Nick. You don't need to convince me. So I visit him. That's my choice, too."
"He said he wasn't supposed to tell me," I said, because that had to mean something. I'd felt like Tyler was keeping something from me, and now I was sure of it. "What do you talk about? What did he tell you?" He tipped his head back, looking at the ceiling.
"Nothing. We just... talk. He's not supposed to tell you because of this, Nick. This is the reason."
I stuck my finger at the center of his chest. "Don't lie to me." His jaw twitched.
"I don't lie to you, and you know it."
That used to be something I was sure of. There used to be nobody I trusted more. But the fact remained, he hadn't told me that he visited my father, and he didn't want me to know. "Just tell me why, Tyler."
"Give it a rest. There's nothing to tell."
He stepped closer.
"He's your family, and you were mine. You left, but he didn't. I don't just cut people off when they no longer suit me. It's that simple, Nick."
I wrapped my arm around my waist. "When they no longer suit me. I haven't been yours in 10 years. He's not your problem anymore. How's that for simple?" I thought for a second that he was going to argue, Tell me all the reasons I was wrong, all the ways I didn't understand. Instead, he laughed. He laughed with his eyes closed, and it came out like a grimace.
Okay. No problem.
He took a step up, then pulled out his key ring.
10 years, huh? I could have sworn it was sooner.
He took a key off his ring, mine, and threw it to me, but I let it clatter in the stairwell, echoing as it fell.
Listen, I have to take care of some stuff. Do me a favor and stay away.
And then I felt it. The punch to my stomach. The feeling that there was something worth holding on to, and I was losing it. Again. I put my hand up to stop him, but his eyes were closed.
Get him out of here. I want to come downstairs and have a fucking drink, and I don't want to have to look at him.
Tyler.
Don't, Nick.
He gestured toward the bar.
I can't.
He dropped his arm.
Look, let's make this easy. You asked me to leave you alone, and now I'm asking you to do the same. It's what we both want, right? See? Simple.
And there I stood, an 18-year-old girl breaking up with her boyfriend, the finality of metal on concrete in a dingy stairwell. We'd never had this moment, and maybe it was my fault for slipping away, or his fault for pretending I hadn't, but we'd never officially called us off. Silly to think about now, that those scattered moments made up the longest and most meaningful relationship of my life. That maybe we'd been together these 10 years because we never broke up. I just left. Just cut people off when they no longer suit me. This was the feeling I couldn't stomach the thought of back then. Why I slunk off in the middle of the night without so much as a goodbye. But 10 years' time didn't change it at all. Didn't stop the nausea from rolling through. Didn't change the look on his face. I turned away so he couldn't see what it did to me. I floundered for my key, stomped back into the bar, and slammed my hand down on the counter. Jackson watched me out of the corner of his eye.
Went that well, huh?
Don't be an asshole, I said. Please. He placed one last vodka on the bar.
On me. Time to go.
I took the glass, but he grabbed my arm.
Really?
He said.
Go.
This time, I downed half the drink myself before making it back to the table.
Come on.
I had to pull Everett toward the car. He was solidly past his tipping point. I rifled through my purse to find my keys, and Everett put his hands on either side of me on the car roof.
Hi,
he said as I looked up at him. He kissed me, his teeth colliding with mine, his hand sliding up my side. Hold that thought, I said, pushing him back. Tyler's apartment had a view to the parking lot, and I was not, as Jackson implied, that cruel.
I think,
he said,
I'm drunk.
That would be an accurate assessment, I said, helping him to the passenger side. He paused, his hand on my shoulder, his gaze tilted up at the building.
Someone's watching us,
he said. Get in the car, Everett.
I felt it all day, though.
He swayed slightly, then eased into his seat.
Like someone's watching. Do you feel it?
You're just not used to the woods, I said. But a chill ran up my spine, because I did. I felt eyes in the woods, outside the darkened windows. I felt them everywhere. The lantern was moving on the front porch again, casting shadows and ghosts.
This place is trippy in the dark,
Everett said, following me up the walk.
It's trippy when you're drunk, I said, leading him inside.
Everett fell back on the couch, his head tipped toward the ceiling.
This is gonna hurt in the morning.
I'll make a fire, I said.
It'll be like a furnace.
It gets cold at night, I said. Rest. While he lay there with his eyes closed and his arm out to the side like a rag doll, I checked the entire house, window by window, the back door with a chair wedged under the handle, my unlatched bedroom window. Nothing looked disturbed. Last, I stood at the entrance to the master closet, shining my phone light inside. The vent in my dad's closet was exactly as I'd left it, but for how much longer?
Nicolette?
Everett called from downstairs. There was no time. Coming, I called. I helped Everett up to bed, skirted out from under him as he tried to pull me down with him. Be right back, I said. I unscrewed the vent and took the journals and papers downstairs where I sat in front of the crackling fire. I skimmed everything, the journals turning out to be more like ledgers, and felt the puzzle pieces lining up for just a second, and the spare sheets of paper, descriptions of my mother's jewelry or receipts of sales or itemized lists from pawn shops. I tore the pages from the journal, crumpling them up and tossed them into the fire, watched as the edges curled, turning to black. Then I pulled the papers from the drawer, everything on the dining room table that I'd been trying to find meaning in, the bank withdrawals, the highlighted receipts. I burned them all. They turned to ash, to nothing, to smoke. I no longer had the luxury of perusal, of gradual and gentle understanding. It was coming with a vengeance, like the leaves in the fall, turning colors in warning, and then, with a strong wind, they all fall down. The day before. Day 11. The teenagers scattered throughout the clearing were finally asleep, and I carefully wove through their campsite, stepping over empty cans and sleeping bags, heading for the narrow path to the caverns. Dawn was already breaking through the trees, the sky pink and hazy, but darkness beckoned from the entrance of the caverns. Time didn't exist down there. Too many angles for the light to slip through. Too much distance. You had to move by feel and instinct. My hands on Tyler's waist, following in his steps, Corinne's laughter echoing from deep inside. 10 years ago, these caverns had belonged to us. From my house, in a car, they're a good 10 miles away, but through the woods it's more like 2, 2.5. Corinne and Bailey and I used to walk here before we were old enough to drive, not just for the caverns. That came after. That was always the dare. First, there was the clearing where we'd all meet up, just like these kids. This site used to be privately run and maintained, but now it was abandoned, halfway to disrepair, yet with old restroom facilities and plumbing that still worked. The perfect place for bonfires or parties. It belonged to the teenagers and, like a spell, was forgotten as soon as they moved on. We'd sneak through the rusted cavern gates, following the roped path deep inside as far as we dared. Our flashlights off, the chill running up our spines, a tap on the shoulder. Truth or dare? In the darkness, we were all hands and laughter and whispers. We clung to one another or pressed ourselves against the damp walls, trying to outlast everyone else, pretending to see ghosts, pretending to be ghosts. Until someone gave in and flicked a light back on. The official cavern tours had shut down a generation before, after an accident. A couple left behind, lost in the total darkness, and only one alive by morning. The woman slipped along the slick rocks, hit her head, and her husband couldn't find her in the dark. Circled the cavern on his hands and knees, spiraling in, calling her name, never making contact. Yelled for help from the locked gate, his pleas swallowed up by the endless forest. It's disorienting down there. Might seem unlikely to be trapped in the same cave and never find the other person, but if you've been there, you knew. It could happen. They found her in a puddle of her own blood and him not 20 yards away. They'd been exploring a narrow tunnel off the trail, didn't notice when everyone left until the lights went off. Felt their way back into the main cavern, searching for the path, for the rope to follow back to the entrance. That was when he lost her. Of course, that was his story. But then there were the rumors, the whispers that lived on. He killed her. He meant to. Or it was an accident, a fit of passion, a push too hard. Or like Daniel told us, the monster made him do it. It lived in the woods, and this was its home. And it would speak to you only in a whisper that sounded like your own echo. Either way, this place shut down, the generator burned out, and the trail of lights turned off for good. and with it, the town revenue. There used to be more of a tourist draw. The caverns nearby, the mountains all around, and the river cutting through. Johnson Farm and the sunflowers within driving distance. People pulling onto the shoulder of the road, walking through them like a maze, cameras strung around their necks. We still have the draw of the mountains, the view, the way of life that people found quaint. But the town 20 miles away had a railroad with a cartoonish train and a scenic day trip. And it also had the river and the mountains, the proximity to Johnson Farm, therefore taking all of the remaining visitors. They bolted the metal gates into the smooth mouth of the caverns, tied it up with chains and a padlock, stuck a sign out front, "Danger, forbidden, keep out." Like catnip, a goddamn bat signal in the sky. Teenagers, come. And come we did. The gates and the padlock were mostly for show. Everyone knew someone who had a key. There were probably 8 different copies of that key floating around by the time we graduated, passed down like a rite of passage, senior to freshman. The dares, the bets, the dark privacy of the rooms losing their appeal after graduation. When those seeking privacy and secrets outgrew the cold walls, the damp floor, moving on to the motel halfway between this town and the next. When Corinne disappeared, the cops couldn't search everywhere. There was just too much area and too few resources, until help from the state arrived, especially for an 18-year-old with no definite sign of foul play. They couldn't rule out the possibility that she'd run. But the caverns were close to the main road between the fair and our town, a semi-paved access road from when it had county funding. It was a convenient place to leave a body. Jackson was the one who suggested it as the cops organized us into search parties 2 days after Corinne disappeared. Did anyone check the caverns? They couldn't not check. Not with us all standing around, about to head out on our own with flashlights and desperation and an illegal key. We were there when the cops went in, Bailey beside Jackson, her face resting against his chest, his T-shirt already stained with her eye makeup. Tyler, his fingers laced with mine, his grip too tight. Daniel, his arms folded across his chest, sullen and anxious. The police had this big tool ready to cut the chains, but they didn't need it. The padlock was open, the chains unwound, the gate hanging slightly ajar. The darkness beckoning. Jimmy Bricks went down with a big spotlight, and Officer Fraze tried to keep us all back as we stood with the gathered crowd. We waited forever, the waiting tightening my throat, the summer air too thick and filled with the scent of decay. They were down there for over an hour, but the only thing they brought back up was the ring. The ring was beautiful, one of a kind. Interlocking silver bands with a row of tiny blue stones between them. They'd slid it across a table in front of me the next day in a sealed plastic bag.
"Take a closer look,"
Officer Fraze had said. Some of the stones were blackened, coated with dried blood. I'd closed my eyes, shook my head. "Not hers," I said. In the following weeks, they tried to track down its origin. We heard about it from Officer Fraze, who was married to the school secretary, who told her book club. They tried to link it to Corinne, then to Jackson, with a receipt or an ID from a pawn shop, but the ring appeared just like Corinne had vanished. From nothing, into nothing. Bailey said it wasn't Corinne's. Jackson said it wasn't Corinne's. But the police clung to the idea of it, that there was something we didn't know about her. Something that had led her here, and she'd seeped into the cavern walls. Her bone, the smooth rock. Her teeth, the jagged stone. Her clothes, disintegrating in the darkness. The only thing left behind, the metal of a ring and the blood it clung to. Why else would Jackson tell the police to search there? It's what the guilty do when the guilt threatens to drown them. It's human nature to want to tell, to be absolved. Then they sealed the caverns back up. Fresh chains, fresh gate, new lock, no keys. As far as I knew, they hadn't been opened in the last 10 years. I thought maybe that was what the kids sleeping in the clearing were here to do last night. I thought that they were here to look for Annalise as we once searched for Corinne. That maybe they knew something more, something they were scared to tell. But no. We'd scoured the earth when Corinne disappeared. When the police couldn't, when they wouldn't, we kept looking. We threw ourselves so deep into her disappearance that some of us never managed to climb back out. The monster lives in there, Corinne used to say. Then she'd grab my hand and pull me in, all breathy laughter. Come find us, she'd call, and we'd hear footsteps, from Jackson or Tyler, tiny beams of light cast about on the floor as we darted out of their paths. I stood in front of those gates now, my hands encircling the rusted iron bars, listening to the breeze rush into the darkness and echo back in a low-pitched howl. The lock was closed, the chain covered in a coarse moss that slid off too easily, coating my palms. I traced the path of the chain to the padlock. I tugged at the bars, but they didn't give at all against the stone. Barely made a noise as the padlock and the chains resisted. My fingers tightened on the bars, and I stepped close. My face pressed up against the iron, my eyes focused on the place the light disappeared around the corner. "Hello?" I whispered, listening to the word bounce off the walls. I cleared my throat and tried once more. "Annalise?" Nothing but my own voice echoed back. I tried the gates from a different angle, pulling the metal bars parallel to the rock, seeing if they'd give, slide. I gripped the bars and shook until I heard a girl mumble from somewhere nearby. "Did you hear that?" I slipped into the trees before she could notice. I had a moment of panic, that I wouldn't be able to find my way back home without a path to trace. It had been so long since I'd done it on my own, but it all came back. The downtrodden walking trail to the clearing where I used to meet Tyler, to the sounds of the river which I followed home. The heat wave hadn't broken, and I was sweating and dirty by the time I reached my backyard. Seeing Daniel's car parked in the driveway, I froze at the edge of the woods. I walked to the back door outside the kitchen, trying to get a sense of where he was. Heard him on the phone, his shoes pacing on the hardwood.
"Just tell me if she's there."
A pause, more pacing.
"Just no bullshit. Tell me she's okay. We had a fight and... she's... I don't know. Not doing well."
The pacing picked up.
"No, I showed up and her car's here and all her shit's here, but she's nowhere."
"Daniel?" I pushed through the back door, same way I came out. He rounded the corner, the phone pressed to his ear.
"Never mind,"
he said, sliding the phone back into his pocket.
"Hey, Nick,"
he said, all drawn out and slow, hands on his hips, feigned relaxation.
"Where were you?"
"I was out for a walk." His eyes strayed to my clothes, same as yesterday's, and he frowned.
"In the woods?"
"No," I said, "down the road." I cleared my throat. "Hey, do you know, did anyone check the caverns?" The line between his eyes deepened, the corners of his mouth tipping down.
"What are you talking about?"
"The caverns. Did the police ever look inside?" Daniel looked me over quickly, and I balled my fists to hide the dirt and moss.
"I think we should let them do their job,"
he said.
"Doesn't do any good getting involved."
"Still, someone should check."
"Nick,"
he said, waving his hand.
"I came to talk to you."
He rolled his neck. For a second, I thought he was gearing up for an apology, and I mentally prepared to do the same.
"It's about Dad. I've got some good news and some bad news."
"Nope, guess not."
"First,"
Daniel said,
"we have a court date."
We had two affidavits vouching for Dad's general incompetence and a petition that Everett had helped me draw up that would put Daniel as the primary guardian, then me, on condition of Daniel's death.
"But it's not for another 2 months."
"2 months?" I asked.
"Yeah. And if Dad still refuses to sign the paperwork to put the house on the market, it will take until after the guardianship hearing for us to list it."
"I'll talk to him." Daniel cleared his throat.
"Maybe you should go home."
My eyes latched onto his. He was always telling me whether to stay or go, and I wanted to know why. Why he wanted me gone. I thought you wanted my help. You told me. You told me you wanted me to come.
I can take care of it,
he said. His face closed off, unreadable. Typical Daniel. I'll talk to Dad, I said. He'll sign the papers. We'll sell the house. He nodded, stared off into the woods.
Bring your phone next time you're out, so I don't worry.
There was a police cruiser in the first row of the half-empty parking lot of Grand Pines, and I instinctively parked near the back. I knew it was irrational, but still. The cop walked out of the building just as I left the car, and I stood beside the door, reshuffling the listing paperwork. There was something vaguely familiar about the way he walked, looking down at his feet with his hands shoved in his pockets. Something about his jet-black hair cropped perfectly against his light brown skin. Cinnamon, Jackson had called it on Bailey, as if her ethnicity had a scent or a flavor. Mark, I called, pushing off my car. Mark Stewart? The cop Annalise had left a message for before she disappeared. I have a few questions about the Corinne Prescott case. Can we set up a time to talk? Mark Stewart. Here. He froze halfway to his car, stranded on the blue lines of a handicap space. I was jogging toward him, my flip-flops slapping against the pavement, the papers slipping from their stack under my arm. I secured them between my elbow and waist and gestured to myself, my heart pounding in my chest. Nick Farrell, remember? His eyes widened in surprise, but he quickly replaced it with a nod and a smile.
Hi, Nick. Wow, it's been...
He let the thought linger in the air between us. Yeah, I said. God, you got tall. I searched his face, but it was completely closed off, both familiar and unreadable. Bailey had always been captivating, the type of person you couldn't tear your eyes from no matter how many times you'd seen her. Their mom was from Japan. Her father had met her there during his 4 years of Navy service, and she had this partially stilted accent that Bailey could mimic perfectly. The same combination on her brother, the dark hair, the brown eyes, the cinnamon skin, somehow had the opposite effect. He faded into a group, shrank from our focus. I wondered whether he and Annalise had been close, if he knew something more that he'd kept for himself. Maybe why she'd asked about the Corinne Prescott case in the first place. Mark had been 14 when I left. The only thing I really remembered about his personality was that he was exceptionally goofy in that immature boy way in his own home. Outside, he was morose and quiet, and when I ran into him outside of his house, away from his family, he blushed when he saw me, like he was embarrassed that I knew the other version. "What are you doing here?" I asked. His cheeks tinged red, and I was glad to see I still had that effect. It would make him overcompensate by oversharing.
"Got a tip,"
he said, staring past me.
"From a nurse. About a potential crime. We're required to follow up."
I nodded, tried to steady my hand, tried to slow my breath. Could be anyone. How many patients are there? What did that brochure say? 620? Maybe 260. Still, less than a 1% chance. So, how have you been? Still living in town?
Nah, just work there. I live a few miles from Bailey. Nice area. You know.
He was acting like I had a clue about Bailey. I didn't know where she lived or what she did. Didn't want to ask around, to draw attention to the uncomfortable truth. Bailey and I didn't speak. Not after Corinne had disappeared. Hardly ever a day since. That box in the police station... It does things to people. Makes you tell things about each other. Becomes a permanent record of your betrayal with your signature below. Well, I said, it was really good seeing you, Mark. I was almost at the door when he called after me.
Hey, Nick,
he said, using some voice I'd never heard from him. His cop voice.
You in town for a while?
I shrugged, just taking care of some loose ends. I gripped the papers tighter to keep my hands from shaking. He didn't ask why I was here or who I was visiting. He already knew. As soon as the door shut behind me, I raced to my father's room. Dad was particularly disoriented, or rattled, or both. He sat on the edge of the bed, staring at the wall, faintly rocking back and forth. I knocked on the open door, but he didn't answer. "Dad?" I called. He turned to look at me, then went back to the wall and the rocking. He was shutting down. There was no imminent danger, no reason for the director to call Daniel or schedule a meeting or explain her concerns. They were probably quite pleased with themselves. But for me, this was scarier. He wasn't clawing for sanity or fighting for understanding or raging against the unfamiliar. He was letting go. On the wall across from the bed were pictures of us, of me and Daniel and the nurses and doctors. People he shouldn't be afraid of. People he should remember. He was staring right through them now. I stood beside my picture. My hair was shorter in it, and I was smiling, and Dad had his arm slung over my shoulder. It was from when we brought him here last year, taken in this very room, because we couldn't find any recent photos of the two of us. "With daughter, Nick," it said underneath, in Daniel's handwriting. Dad kept rocking. He was mumbling something, repeating words to himself, all strung together in nonsense. "Dad," I tried again, but he still looked right through me. Then he stopped, paused, focused.
"Shayna?"
he asked. I closed my eyes, and he went back to rocking. There was no picture of my mother on the walls. It had been a hard decision, the one Daniel and I wavered over the most. Whether to put her up there and fill him with the hope that she still existed, or whether to pretend she never did. Which was worse? Daniel and I debated over dinner the night before we moved him in. I was the one who made the decision, because I knew. The losing. The losing of something you thought you had. That was far, far worse. I stepped into the hallway, the light too bright, the buzzing from the fluorescence drowning out the low hum of voices in the other rooms. "Hey," I said to the first official-looking person walking down the hall. No scrubs, business casual, hair loose, and a bird-like face. I recognized her from the last time I was here. I grabbed her arm as she tried to walk past with a stiff smile. "What did you do to him?" I asked. Maybe it was the way I grabbed her arm, or maybe the look in my eye, but she blinked slowly and said, "I'll page the doctor." "No, I want to speak with Karen Adelson," I said firmly, trying to summon my best impression of Everett, calling the director by her full name. "She's in a meeting." If Everett were here, he'd have her pulled out of that meeting without it seeming like his idea. He'd let this woman talk herself in circles. She shouldn't be long. Oh, I see the problem here. Well, maybe I'll just peek my head in, see if she can spare a moment. Make it seem like her idea all along. "I need to talk to her," I said. "I'll let her know as soon as she's done." "Now," I said. "I need to talk to her now. Has someone been to see my dad? Is that why he's silently rocking back and forth on his bed right now? Is this what you all mean by," I raised my hands in makeshift quotes, "exceptional patient care?" Her cheeks flushed. "Fine. You can sit in the waiting room. I'll tell her you're here." I followed her determined steps down the hall. "Why were the police here?" I asked. Her step faltered, but she kept moving. "I don't know. The cops showed up an hour ago." "Cops or cop?" I asked. "Mark Stewart?" She paused at the office door, turned to me with a quizzical look. "One cop." She cleared her throat. "Asian, I think?" She blushed again like that wasn't the PC way to describe someone. "Just a guy. Just a goofy, sullen kid. Mark." "And you let him talk to my dad? I will hold you all personally accountable if this..." I made an arm movement trying to encompass everything my dad was at the moment. "Gets worse." She gestured toward the couch, then sat at the desk in the outer office. "I was in here. I have no idea what happened. She picked up the phone and pressed a button. I have Patrick Farrell's daughter in the waiting room. Karen Adelson was outside her office, escorting a couple and making apologies for the interruption within a solid minute. The director held out her hands.
Nicolette, please come in.
As if she'd been expecting me. Her office had potted plants and a little Zen garden on a coffee table, a miniature rake with lazy, curving lines through the sand. What did you do to my dad? I saw Officer Stewart in the parking lot, and my dad is practically catatonic in his room. What the hell happened?
Sit, please, she said.
I sat in the straight-back chair in front of her desk, ignoring the couch she was gesturing toward. Tough to feel self-righteous when you're stuffed into an oversized couch in front of a Zen garden. She took her time walking to the other side of the desk. When she sat, she folded her hands on top of the desk blotter, the blue veins running over her knuckles, making her look about 10 years older than I'd originally thought. 60s. Dad's age. God, he shouldn't be here.
Ms. Farrell, she began, I cannot stop the police from questioning a patient, as much as I wish that weren't the case. It was just a few questions. Apparently, your father might have been a potential witness to a crime.
I laughed. Sure. I'm sure they were hoping he'd be a great witness they could use on the stand.
Ms. Farrell, she said, even if he was deemed unfit legally, our hands are tied. It is not our legal right to ban the police from questioning a patient. That responsibility is yours.
Have you seen him? He's a mess. Nothing he says makes any sense.
Look, he was talking to a nurse, and the nurse says he called her Nick, and he kept mentioning a missing girl, that he knew what happened. She had to report it, you see.
I fought to keep the surprise from my face, but a wave of nausea rolled through, working its way from my stomach to my throat.
No, don't you see? If he thought someone else was me, then he already didn't know what he was saying. Don't you see the fallacy in your logic? Nothing he says makes any sense. On the contrary, your father is a very smart man. There's always truth in there somewhere. Maybe you should ask him. Ask him about the missing girl, see what he says.
Were you there? I asked. She took a moment to compose herself, and I recognized her pause as a tactic Everett would use. Be calm. Calm the situation. Keep the emotion low. Grasp the upper hand.
No. He insisted it be private. They are the police, after all. My hands are tied.
I pushed back from the table. When I got angry, I couldn't stop the tears, as if the two emotions were all tangled up in each other. And that made me angrier since I seemed weak when I wanted to seem confident and demanding like Everett. The best I could muster was the grand gesture of storming out of the room. It took over an hour for Dad to recognize me, and I sat in his room the whole time, waiting it out. Then it all seemed to click. He looked at the picture on the wall and me on the guest chair in the corner.
Nick,
he said, fingers drumming against the surface of his dresser.
Nick, your friend. Your friend's brother. Did you know he's a cop? I didn't know.
It's okay, Dad. I'll take care of it. Tell me what he asked. Tell me what you said. I stood and closed the door, and he was watching me from the sides of his eyes.
About that girl. That girl who disappeared.
I shivered. You don't have to answer. It was 10 years ago, and Mark probably doesn't even remember.
No, not Corinne. I mean, yes, her, but also the other. The other girl. The...
Annalise Carter? You couldn't possibly be a witness. You've been in here for... I cleared my throat. You were here when she went missing.
How long, Nick? How long have I been in here? It's important.
I paused. About a year. He sucked in a breath.
I'm late.
Dad, what did they ask? I said, trying to keep his focus.
They wanted to know if I knew her well. And your brother. Always your brother. He never should have done that.
He stared at the side of my face as if he could see the mark Daniel left 10 years earlier, as if it happened just a moment ago. I felt the sting rise to the surface like a memory, and I ran my tongue along the inside of my cheek, expecting to taste blood. The swing of his arm that had sentenced him to constant suspicion.
And if I thought they were related, Corinne and Annalise. Yes, that's what he wanted to know. There's too much in that house, Nick.
There's nothing in the house, Dad. I promise.
There's plenty,
he said.
I need to... I keep memories. A record to help my mind,
The nurse opened the door. Mrs. Adelson wants him evaluated by the doctor. Come on, Patrick, she said to him, without making eye contact with me. He stood and leaned down as he passed, his heavy hand resting on my shoulder.
With the skeletons,
he whispered.
Get it. Get it first.
I spent the ride home calling people who didn't pick up the phone. Daniel was at work, on site somewhere. Tyler was probably busy at work, too. Everett didn't pick up, but sent me a text after saying he was stuck in a meeting and would call later. When I pulled into the driveway, Laura was waiting on the front porch, leaning back on her elbows, shifting uncomfortably on the wooden steps. Something was wrong. We didn't have a random drop-in relationship. We hadn't spoken since the baby shower. And what kind of news couldn't she give over the phone? I held my breath as I walked toward the steps, my heart pounding, before I saw the pots and containers of soil spread out on the porch.
Hey, she said, slightly unsure of herself. Dan said you guys could use some stuff for the garden, and I'm in full-on nesting mode, but I've run out of things to nest with. I'd do it myself, but I topple over when I try to garden now. It's embarrassing.
Thank you. You didn't have to do this, but thank you.
And, she said, I wanted to apologize for Saturday, for my friends.
I shook my head fast. Don't. It's fine.
It's not, she said. They sometimes don't think. They're good people, really, but that doesn't excuse it.
Okay, I said, just to get her to stop. I sat down on the step beside her. I'd invite you in to cool down, but I think it's probably worse in there. Do you want a drink?
No, I'm fine, she said. Are you busy? Or do you have time for me to walk you through some of this?
Her voice was so hopeful, I couldn't send her away. Not like this. Not right now. Not when everyone else was unreachable and all I had left were my dad's words for company. With the skeletons, he said. I felt my mind wanting to dive down the rabbit hole after him.
Yes, I said. I have time.
Laura had a scent to her, the fragrance from the garden catching, clinging, taking root in her, like she herself was blooming or thriving. Her skin had gone transparent, or her veins had darkened as blood rushed under her skin, and I could see the fine map running through her. Life, I thought.
These are full shade, she said, gesturing to a pot. So I thought they'd be perfect for the side garden.
She paused, frowned.
Some animal really made a mess of it.
I pushed off the steps and reached my hand down to help her stand. She smoothed the fabric of her dress, stretching her neck to look up at the house.
The place has good bones, she said. It just needs a little work. Dan's glad you're here.
He has a funny way of showing it. She brushed the comment aside with a swipe of her hand.
He's got a lot on his plate, between work, your dad, the property, and the baby. He's just stressed.
She grinned.
I'm planning to ask him to put an addition on our house, but figure I should probably wait until all this has passed.
She waved her hand around her head, and I wasn't sure whether she was talking about the property or everything. Good thinking. I picked up the larger flower pots, started walking toward the side of the house. Laura carried a few of the smaller ones, trailing behind.
I know he's not perfect, she said. I know you've had your differences, but he takes care of your dad, and he takes care of us. He's going to be a good father. You can see that, right?
Of course, I said automatically. It was the expected response, the right thing to say. Laura frowned as if she could see right through me.
He was just a kid back then, Nick. Same as you.
As if this was something they had discussed. As if Daniel had drawn her into our family with all of our history, not just as an extension, but something more. A part of our past as much as our future. She was leaning against the siding, watching me. I sighed and nodded.
Okay, Laura, I said, brushing my hands on the sides of my pants. Where do we start?
My cell phone rang when I was in the shower, as the soil clumped and swirled down the drain. I reached my hand through the curtain and hit the speaker so I wouldn't get the phone wet. Hello? I said, expecting Daniel or Everett. But the voice. The voice was every bit as sharp as my memory. Tight and quick. Soft and unsure.
It's Bailey, she said.
Hi, I said, like an idiot. I turned off the water and stood naked, my hair dripping and goosebumps forming on my skin.
They're bringing your dad down to the station tomorrow for questioning.
She let out a slow breath. I don't know why I'm telling you this. Nothing keeps in this town. Not in the bed, not over the dinner table, not at the bar, not between family and friends and neighbors, not even between us. I was full of panic. Full of thoughts, full of a to-do list forming in my head, blurry and unreadable. Everett. Call Everett. I owe you one. I don't know how to thank you. My words echoed through the bathroom, and I had to strain to hear Bailey under my own breathing. A pause, and then, stay away from me. If these are my debts, if I'm paying them off, then maybe this is hers. I called Everett with a towel held to my body, dripping on the linoleum.
I was just getting ready to call you back. I'm sorry,
he said. I need advice, I said.
Okay,
he said.
About the guardianship? You got the affidavits, right?
They're trying to question my dad. About a crime. Everett, he's not in his right mind. My voice wavered. I don't know what he's saying or what he'll say. I have to stop it. Tell me how to stop it.
Back up. What's happening?
I told him fragments. A missing girl from 10 years ago. Another missing person, dragging the case out for closer inspection. It all came out high-pitched and clipped. My voice was laced with tears.
I'll take care of it,
he said. But what do I do? Who do I talk to?
I said I'll take care of it. Call the facility, give them my number. Tell them to call me if anyone, anyone, tries to talk to your father. Tell them we'll sue if they don't. We won't have a case, but tell them anyway.
I did what he said, called Karen Adelson and left a firm and unwavering message on her voicemail, which I'd practiced 3 times in the mirror. Then I called Daniel and told him what Bailey had told me and what Everett had said. I tried Tyler again. I considered leaving a message, but knew that would be a bad idea. Anything left could be used in an investigation when they broke us all open again, and they were already looking at Tyler for motive. It had happened before. I remembered one of the other things that had made it into the box in Corinne's case. A recording of a voicemail. Corinne to Jackson. I'm so sorry, she'd said. Her voice choked. So unlike her. The detective from the state played it for me to see if I knew what she was talking about. Please, Jackson. Please come back. I'll be at the fair. Find me there. I'll do anything. Just don't do this. Don't. Please. Jackson swore they never met up. But if he had, the last thing on record was Corinne and Jackson meeting up. It was enough. A pleading voicemail, and nobody saw her after. It was enough to convict in a place like this. I hung up when Tyler's voicemail picked up, and I started searching. I searched the house for skeletons. I had to get them. I had to get them first. The day before. Day 10. I couldn't sleep in the house, worrying that there was something I was missing. Someone who'd been in my house, possibly out there right now. I came out to the back porch sometime after midnight for the cooler air, the clearer head. I sat on the back steps but kept the outside lights off. I felt too exposed otherwise, with nothing but my dad's words echoing in my head. The woods have eyes. I stared off into the